Okay, you should all be able to hear me. Yes, good morning. Glad to be here. I'm enjoying this fine October brisk weather. It's kind of a nice change. And so speaking of changes, my sermon today is called Making Adjustments. And I want to point out just how weird and crazy of a year it's been. It's been hard to for me to just adjust to everything that's happened. I mean, it feels like we went from 1 week to being 110 degrees, and then the next week it was like low 80s, and there was almost no fall whatsoever. And then also there's been one thing after another happening. There's been like way more hurricanes this year, fires, there's been floodings, there's been shootings, presidential tweets that we have to hear about all the time, and paper towels being thrown to Puerto Rico. It's just been a really busy, weird year. Just a lot of stuff going on. But the one thing you can always count on in October, and the one thing I really like about October, is that we weren't deprived of the Fall Classic, otherwise known as the baseball playoffs. So there's just something about baseball that's really compelling. I know a lot of people, some people may say it's boring, but I think baseball is about overcoming the odds. It never ceases to amaze me when, no matter how improbable something seems in baseball, if you have patience for it, you get to see it happen. The improbable happens. The things that seem impossible, they happen. The great comebacks, the defying of the stats and the odds, when you think about them, it's mesmerizing. But I'm not really talking about all the crazy stats, because they have crazy stats now that they come up with to try to make the game more interesting. And I was talking to Mark about this, and it's ridiculous things where they have these qualifiers, and the qualifiers make something sound more important than it is, you know. Now batting, number 42, he's hit 12 straight home runs against left-handed pitching during night games in ballparks with dome stadiums that are near water, when the moon is out and when there are no strikes and when the umpire is wearing blue socks. So that's an exaggeration, but that's really the kind of stats that I'm listening to. Like, well, what about in the he's got the best average in the American League. Well, that's great, but there's like 10 people in the National League that have a better average than him? And so it just gets crazy. It's like me saying that 60% of the time, I'm right all the time. It doesn't make any sense. But the only stat that we can know for sure doesn't have a qualifier is found in John 15:5. John 15:5 says, "I am the vine, and you are the branches. He that abideth in me, and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. For without me you can do nothing." That's the main thing we need to know. We look at our stats, we look at our average, we look at the things that we accomplish. But we can't accomplish anything without God. He's the root of our existence. I can still appreciate baseball. It's much more than stats and mound visits to me. What makes me appreciate it, as opposed to like other sports, and maybe it's not, maybe it doesn't, maybe it could go across other sports, but I especially notice it in baseball, is that every player strives for an edge on their opponent. And it's a very psychological battle. Every pitch, it causes each player to constantly adjust their strategy. And you can have a really great hitter, but even the great ones have a weakness. So what pitchers do is they get the scouting report on the hitter. And they see where, statistically, he can't hit the ball. And the pitcher will throw their pitches right in that spot to try to keep them from hitting. Now the batters, they know this. And they train themselves. They know that the pitcher is going to throw it where they can't hit it. So they train themselves to be able to hit the ball where they know the pitcher is going to throw it. So then the pitcher then makes an adjustment to change the speed of the pitch along with a new location because he knows that the batter knows that the pitcher knows. Okay, and so on and on. And then the hitter, he chokes up on the bat to shorten his swing because he knows that the pitcher knows. And then one team will put a shift on the other team and the batter will then decide to bunt. I seen that yesterday. That's why I mentioned that one. And this can go on and on and on. It's a mind game that is just overwhelming. Expectations are ordinary, but the outliers are fantastic. Here's another outlier that connects to what I'm going to talk about. In Luke 9, 23 and 24. Luke 9, 23 and 24. It says, "And he said to them all, 'If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. For whosoever will save his life shall lose it. But whosoever will lose his life for my sake, the same shall save it.'" See, I used to watch baseball thinking that nothing great ever happens. But it only takes one really amazing situation to hook you. Seeing the nearly impossible feat of the Red Sox in 2004, I'll give you a little background. I always remember this. Partially because I had just lost my father that year. And so I didn't really care too much about baseball because I was just trying to stay busy and work. But I remember I was working at the bowling alley and off of Florin Road in Sacramento, and the baseball game was on, and I didn't want to have nothing to do with it. First of all, the Yankees were winning. They were playing the Red Sox, and they were up 3-0, 3-0 in a 7-game series. And I was just done. I was like, this is going to be a lame year. Forget this. But I'll always remember that year because that was the year the Red Sox did the impossible. And they came back. No team had ever done that before. They came back and they won 4 games straight. They were down to their last out like 3 different times where they could have lost. And one little thing happens. They get a pinch runner and they steal a base and then they score a run, they tie the game, they take it in extra innings. Just the impossible happened. Fast forward to 2011. My favorite team, the Cardinals, were in the World Series. It was game 6. And they were down their last out. Down by 2 runs. I thought it was over. It was impossible. They can't come back. That was probably the most miraculous victory I've ever seen, the way they came back. Something that's miraculous is that despite all of the odds, despite our sins and us being separated from God, that if we take up our cross daily and follow Jesus, we can make adjustments to our lives. And we can see those amazing comebacks. Because He can save us. He can save us from the statistics. See, in order to be successful, you need to constantly be making adjustments to your life. The moment you think you have the perfect swing in life, your adversary, the devil rays, will try to throw you a curveball. By making continual adjustments in your life, what happens? You sharpen your skills. You expand your abilities. You're able to anticipate how the enemy will try to exploit your weaknesses. You're playing that mind game. Too often we get in a comfort zone with God. We think that we've known God long enough, and we have all this experience and knowledge. You know, God, I got it from here. I get the idea. And how often is that the case? Never? We get out of the mindset that we need to continually make adjustments to our lives. And when we do that, we're not ready to serve God in the best way that we can. We can get into a routine where we don't want to break out of because it comes with challenges. I just want to do what's comfortable. We fear the unknown instead of fearing the Almighty. And we suddenly realize that we've put our trust and reliance on things that we worked for instead of the one who provided them to us. You can turn to 1 Kings, starting in chapter 19, and I'm going to go to 2 Kings, chapter 2 afterwards, and I'm going to talk about someone that had to make adjustments to his life. And that someone I'm going to talk about is Elisha. He was the successor to the prophet before him, Elijah. And if you're asking what the difference is between Elisha and Elijah, well, Elisha is spelled with an S-H, and Elijah is spelled with a J. So, just to give you an idea. But we're going to pick up where Elijah was going to, he was instructed by God to hand over his assignment to Elisha. And starting with verse 13 in 1 Kings chapter 19, it says, "It was so when Elijah heard it that he wrapped his face in his mantle and he went out and stood in the entering of the cave. And behold, there came a voice unto him and said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?'" And just to give a background, Elijah was on the run. He felt alone. Jezebel was trying to kill him, along with everybody that he had been dealing with. And he was in this state of, what's the point? Why am I doing this, God? The odds are all against me. And no one is on my side. And going down to verse 17, it says, "It shall come to pass that him that escapeth the sword of Hazael shall Jehu slay, and him that escapeth the sword of Jehu shall Elisha slay. Yet I have left me 7,000 in Israel, all the knees of which I have not bowed unto Baal, and every mouth which has not kissed him. I always like this passage because God corrected the odds. He was correcting the stats with Elijah. Elijah thought he was alone, and God tells him, what are you doing here? You're not alone. There's 7,000 people that worship me just down the road that you don't even know about. I'd like to think that that encouraged Elijah. And when God spoke to him, he also told him about Elisha. They hadn't even met yet. But he told him that he wanted him to go find Elisha and have him be his successor. And so he did that immediately. He says he departed thence in verse 19 and found Elisha, the son of Shaphat, who was plowing his 12 yoke of oxen before him, and he with the 12th. And Elijah passed by him and cast his mantle upon him. So you have Elisha, and he has a job, right? He's out there doing his work. And this man shows up, and he gives him his garment. And the Bible doesn't say it, but I'd like to think that Elijah told him something. Elijah probably said, you know, God sent me to find you. He told me where you were going to be. He said that you were going to be a successor. And maybe as proof of this, here's my robe. What would you do if you were Elisha in that point, in that position? Would you think, this man's crazy? I got work to do? Would you be able to make an adjustment to your life based on this man of God that came to visit you, and the words of God that were being spoken to you? Let's see what Elisha does. 21, he says, he returned back from him, and he took a yoke of oxen. Go back to 20. He said, he left the oxen and ran after Elijah and said, let me, I pray thee, kiss my father and my mother, and then I will follow thee. And he said unto him, go back again, for what have I done to thee? And he returned back from him and took a yoke of oxen and slew them and boiled their flesh with the instruments to the oxen and gave unto the people, and they did eat. Then he arose and went after Elijah and ministered unto him. So you have Elisha. What did he decide to do? He decided to make an adjustment in his life. He was so sure that he wasn't going to go back, that the very same oxen that he was using to plow his field and do his labor and go about his life, he killed them. He sacrificed them. He offered them to Elijah. They ate. He wasn't going to go back to his field. He kissed his mother and father goodbye. This was the first of many adjustments that Elisha would make to his life. It's a hard thing to do. It's a hard thing to know how to adjust your life, let alone to do it. then it doesn't say too much about Elisha in the years to come. The story kind of remains focused on Elijah. But we know that Elisha was by his side, and he was learning. He was continually making adjustments because he was preparing himself for when that enemy would throw the curveball at him. Because his life changed when he gave up his job and he became a follower of the prophet. And his life would change again, and he'd have to make another adjustment when God's words were fulfilled and Elisha would take over as the prophet. If we go to 2 Kings chapter 2, it picks up with the story of Elisha. It says, "It came to pass, when the Lord would take up Elijah into heaven by a whirlwind, that Elijah went with Elisha from Gilgal. And Elijah said unto Elisha, Tarry here, I pray thee, for the Lord hath sent me to Bethel. And Elisha said unto him, As the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee. So they went together to Bethel." He was adamant about this adjustment that he made to his life. He refused to leave Elijah's side. Elijah would repeatedly tell him to wait for him to come back. And he didn't want to leave his side. He didn't want for Elijah to leave his sight. He didn't want to lose him. He became dependent on him probably for a time. So the time came when Elijah was going to be taken away. And they made it all the way to the River Jordan. And they stood by the river, which was an impassable object. They couldn't get through it. And Elijah, he took his mantle, going down to verse 8, and he wrapped it together and he smote the waters. And the waters were divided. Is this the first time that's happened? Have we seen a river divided before, or an ocean, or a sea? This was God's Spirit. This was a miracle. It came to pass when they were gone over that Elijah said unto Elisha, "Ask what shall I do for thee before I be taken away from thee?" And Elisha said, "I pray thee, let a double portion of thy spirit be upon me." Now, is this defying the odds? Is this an easy stat that you should be able to accomplish? It's not what Elijah said. Elijah said, it's a very hard thing that you ask. Maybe he felt he didn't even have the power to grant it, right? Because he didn't. It had to come from God. But he did give him peace about the situation. He told him that if you get to witness me being taken away from you, then it'll be so. But if you don't witness that, then it will not be so. Elisha was so passionate. His yearning was so strong to obtain as much of God's Spirit as he could, to be like Elijah, and to even have the bravery, the courage to ask to have more of God's Spirit, even more than Elijah, be poured upon him. Maybe he knew he would need it. And in verse 11, it says, it came to pass when they went on and they talked, and as they were talking, a chariot of fire comes on the scene, being drawn by horses who were also made up of fire. That had to be something to see, right? This like fireball that's like shaped like a chariot and horses. And then it says that it went in between them. It went in between Elijah and Elisha. And Elijah went up by a whirlwind into heaven. Verse 12 says that Elisha saw it, and he cried, my father, the chariot of Israel and the horsemen thereof. And he saw him no more. And he took hold of his own clothes, and he tore him in half. And he took the clothes of Elijah, which was obviously left behind, fell from the sky and landed next to him. He saw Elijah disappear that day. So he went back after it was over. What else could you do? He's gone. He's coming to the realization that he's going to have to grow a little more. He's going to have to make another adjustment in his life. So he finds himself back at the bank of the Jordan River, the same place where they parted the water before. And in 14, he took Elijah's mantle that fell from him, and he smote the waters and said, "Where is the Lord God of Elijah?" And when he also had smitten the waters, they parted again. And Elisha walked over. And there was witnesses to this. The sons of the prophets, they saw him, and they ran to him. And they realized that the Spirit, the same Spirit that was in Elijah, had now just went into Elisha. And he was branded as a new prophet. And some of them that were with him, they were still worried about Elijah. And they asked Elisha, you know, like, I know you're excited about, you know, your new job, and the Spirit seems to be upon you, the same Spirit, but we're worried about Elijah. What happened to him? We should send out 50 or so guys and try to find what happened, because if Elijah was taken up in a whirlwind, then it probably dropped him somewhere, and he might be hurt, he might be dying. We need to find him. And Elisha, who witnessed the event, he knew that he didn't come back down. He knew that he took Elijah as planned. He knew that God took him, and that he wasn't coming back. And so he urged them. He didn't really urge them. He said, "You don't need to go." I don't know how adamant he was about it. He said, "That's a waste of time. You don't need to go look for him. He's not there." But then they wouldn't give up. And they urged Elisha. And they continued to be worried about him. And so they went anyway. They didn't listen to him. And they searched for him for 3 days. And they came back, and we didn't find him. And then Elisha gets to do like I told you so. As I told you, he wasn't there. I saw the whole thing. He's gone. I don't know why you didn't believe me. Told you not to go. This was the beginning of many miracles that Elijah would begin to perform. One of which talks about it here. How he purified the water of the land. And I just want to touch on the end of this story. I thought it was a really interesting part to bring out. Because after he healed the land, which was like his first major miracle, if we go down to verse 23, it says, he went up from thence unto Bethel, and he was going up by the way, and there came forth little children out of the city who were mocking him and said unto him, go up there, baldy, with your bald head. They're making fun of him. So here's another difference between Elijah and Elisha. Elisha was bald, and Elijah was not. He turned back, and he looked on them, the kids that were making fun of him, and he cursed them in the name of the Lord. And what happened next is pretty defying of the odds. It's pretty incredible. And it makes you question what God's plan is. Because when he cursed them, two she-bears, two giant, like mother bears, came out of the woods. And the bears tore these children in half. And that was the end of that story. And it makes me think, sometimes you get, well, let me just say this first. Isaiah 55:9 says, for as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways. And my thoughts are higher than your thoughts. And sometimes you read something in the Bible and you're like, would God really do that? Would God really have that happen? And it kind of reminds me of a story that I looked at and I was like, man, that's pretty harsh. That's pretty harsh of God. Why would he do that, you know? The story about, you can read in the Old Testament, where there was a man picking up sticks on the Sabbath. And he was, the punishment for that was to kill him. And he executed it. So he was killed for picking up sticks on the Sabbath. And then so I read into it, and I'm like, well, was there something else going on there? Was there more to it than that? Or is God just a harsh God? And unmerciful and unforgiving? Well, it turns out that this man that was picking up sticks, he was using the sticks to offer a sacrifice to another god. And so it turns out that God looks into the hearts of the people that he judges. And his ways are higher than our ways. And if we look at something that happens and we consider it as being harsh, do we have, do we have the judgment to be able to perceive that? Or is his ways higher than our ways? Are his judgments righteous? And I can tell you that his judgments are righteous every time. I don't know why this amazing thing happened. This devastating thing. This sad thing that we think about. But it's recorded in the Bible. And it's one more testament to God's grace, his mercy, his judgment, everything that he is. And he warns in Romans 12:2 to be not conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. You have to think differently. You have to adjust your thinking. Because what we see as right and wrong, God has a different view of it. He has the only view of it. He has the righteous view of it. And that's why we need to constantly make adjustments to our lives. Because he tells us to. He says to transform and renew your mind continually. There's at least five areas in which you and I may find ourselves needing to make adjustments to God. Our circumstances include our job, our home, our finances. We need to adjust how we react to these circumstances. Number two is our relationships. Our relationships can include our family, our friends, our coworkers. How are we interacting with people? How would God want us to do that? Do we need to make adjustments to the way we interact? The third one is our thinking, how we perceive things. Prejudice, racism, your methods, your potential, your biblical theology, the foundation of your actions is predicated on your thinking. The way you perceive something, the way you interpret it. Don't you think that should be adjusted towards God? Or did you just have it right from the beginning? Were you always in the right state of mind of thinking? Commitments. Commitments to our family and our church. And our job, the plans that we make, the traditions that we keep. Do those need to be adjusted? What about our actions? Our prayer lives? How much TV we watch? How giving we are? How giving and how forgiving? How loving. Our actions ultimately make us who we are. Our beliefs about God and his purpose, his ways, and your relationship to him, they all need to be adjusted. Because we don't know it all. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. When I first got my truck, I used to drive a... What did I used to drive, Beto? It's a Buick. You always used to make fun of my Buick, right? I used to drive a Buick. I was comfortable driving my Buick. You know, I was used to it. I could see everything. It was a fast little luxury car, had good acceleration. But then I get my truck, gas guzzler. Hard to maneuver around in, right? And in my car, I could always look back and I could see if there was cars next to me, right? But in my truck, there was this considerable blind spot. Like, it was so bad that I was afraid to even go into the right lane or make a right-hand turn or anything like that. Because I was turning blind. I couldn't see if there was, like, a little mini car underneath me that wasn't there. And so it was a big adjustment for me to get to the point where I could feel safe, you know, changing lanes. And so what I did was the truck, it has these huge mirrors. So I'd be driving down the freeway, and I'd usually, like, just get up next to a diesel truck and go alongside of it. And I would adjust that mirror so that I could see, like, the tires of the diesel truck as I was going the same speed of it. People probably thought I'd think I'm crazy when I'm doing that. Because I'm going like 55, just driving right next to the diesel. But I know if I can see those tires, when I have that mirror adjusted at the right angle, then I'll be able to see a car when I'm trying to change lanes at another time. And so I adjusted that mirror that way, and whenever my mom rides with me, it's kind of a big problem because all she sees is the road and, like, the flashing of the ground just going by, and it makes her sick. So then I have to adjust my mirror back again to a different way. But those are little adjustments that we make in our lives to protect us, to keep us safe, to help us to grow closer in our walk. Are you adjusting your mirrors in your life? 1 Corinthians 10:5. In 1 Corinthians, Paul talks about this. Does the Bible tell us that we need to make adjustments? And does it tell us what we need to adjust our lives from? Well, what's amazing is Paul talked about this exact thing. And he gives this huge example. And he says, you remember with many of them that didn't please God, that they were overthrown in the wilderness? Remember the idolaters that some of them were? As it is written, the people that sat down to eat and drink, and they rose up to play, they committed fornication, they committed and fell in one day, 30 and 20,000. God destroyed them because of their wickedness. They tempted Christ, and the ones that were destroyed are the serpents. They murmured, they complained continually over and over again. And he says in verse 11 that there was a reason why this was all written down. And I'll read the verse first. It says, now all these things happened unto them for an example. And they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are came. Wherefore, let him that thinketh he standeth take heed lest he fall. So, when we look into our rear view mirrors, right? What are we doing? We're looking back. We're looking at what was in the past. And he's telling us here that these things in the Bible, they're not just written as cool stories. They're written so that we can learn from the examples that were given to us. Learn what not to do. So we need to take advantage. And if we don't, he says, we're going to fall. Last night, we played this game at youth group, and the game's called Pulse. And in the game, you have two teams, and you line up and hold hands. And so the person at the end of the line, there's two lines, and there's one person at each end, they can see this coin that's going to be flipped. And if the coin lands on tails, they're supposed to send an electric pulse by squeezing the other person's hand down to the other end so that they will know to go get the object. And so I flip a coin. And sometimes when I flip the coin, it lands on tails. And so then it's just basically a race. It's a pulse race to see who can send that signal to the end of the line so that they can go retrieve that ball. But sometimes the signal is heads, and they're not supposed to do that. But what do you think happens when you get when it lands on heads? Does the signal get sent, or does it not get sent? It doesn't get sent? It does get sent. Sometimes they actually did pretty good, and they didn't send it. And it was hard to see, and it was dark, right? But more often than not, because of your competitive nature, I guess, and wanting to get to that ball first, you tend to not look at the sign to make sure that it's the right sign. And the signal gets sent. And then you have a person that was sent this signal all the way down the line going to get the ball. And you know what happens when they get the ball? Point goes to the other team. It wasn't what they were supposed to do. That happened a few times. You have to pay attention to the adjustments that you're making. You have to know for sure that God is sending you that signal to make that adjustment in your life. You do that by listening to those examples that Paul gave. By looking at the life of Elisha and how he changed his life. In the Bible, you can learn what to do and what not to do. Because the Bible don't pull any punches. There is the most wicked people, the most vile things happen in the Bible. It is as real as it gets. And the reason it is that way is so that you can see the truth. So that you don't fall. So that you know the consequences of what you're getting yourself into. Our scripture reading today was Philippians 2 that Isaiah read. And it says, "My beloved, as ye have always obeyed, not in my presence only, but now much more in my absence." He says, "Work out your own salvation with fear and trembling." What's he telling us there? Make your own adjustment. Don't wait for somebody else to do it. Don't just do what somebody else tells you to do. Everyone has to work out their own salvation. And you cannot work out your salvation if you're in cruise control, if you're just in the mode of, I'm comfortable where I'm at. I pretty much know everything already, so I'm just going to do what I've been doing I can always fall back on what I've been doing. He says, do all things without complaining, without disputing, that you can be blameless and harmless. Be the sons of God without rebuke. And he recognizes that it ain't easy to do, because he says, you're in the midst of a crooked, perverse nation. But I ask more of you because of it. I ask you to be the light of the world. And in order to be the light of the world, who here started out as the light of the world when they were born? Or when they were kids? Nobody? So in order to be the light of the world, you have to make adjustments to your life. When you accept Jesus into your life, he doesn't want you to stay the same. He's not looking for someone who's not willing to make adjustments, not willing to change, not willing to be challenged. He wants to use you and fill you until your cup overflows with joy. One more example, making adjustments. In John chapter 21, Jesus stood on the shoreline. And he had just risen from the grave. He goes to find his disciples. And he finds out that everything that he taught them, they completely gave up on. They decided, oh, well, Jesus is dead now. We don't need to adjust our lives anymore. We can just go back to what we were doing before. So they were out there on the boat and they were fishing. This is in chapter 21, verses 4 through 12. I don't know if I'll read it, but they were fishing. And they didn't know that Jesus was on the shoreline. They didn't know who it was, but somebody starts yelling at them from the shoreline. Hey, what are you doing? Are you catching anything out there? Are you having any luck? And they told him, no. We haven't caught anything all day. We don't know what the problem is. Usually we're able to fish whenever we want. But granted, it's been like 3 years. Because, you know, we were being disciples at one point. We kind of gave up on that, though. Because it was going to be hard. And so this man on the shore, he tells him to make one more adjustment. What if, hey, you should cast your nets on the other side of the boat and see if that adjustment helps. And so they did it. And at some point along the way, they realized that it was Jesus. It was their master, risen from the dead. And I'm sure that the thoughts in their mind flooded over them like, oh, how could we have just gone back to fishing? Why? I mean, here's our Lord, and we're not doing what he told us to do. We're not fulfilling our discipleship. A lot of times we can think we're making adjustments to our lives, But then when it's all said and done, we haven't really changed anything. They caught 153 fish. So many fish that it was making the boat sink. They couldn't even pull it into the boat because it was so heavy. And Jesus said unto them, "Come and dine." And at that moment, they all knew that it was the Lord. They didn't ask who he was. Adjusting our lives to God is the first thing that has to happen in order to begin experiencing him in our daily lives. For some, it's simply following the advice of those above us. For others, it may require a change in our situations, jobs, relationships, the five that I mentioned. Still, for others, it could mean making changes, completely transforming your life in the way that Elisha did, giving up everything and leaving it all behind. But whatever the case, you can be sure that until we adjust our lives to God, we're not going to receive his blessing. So ask him today where you need to adjust to him. May God bless you.